Sri Aurobindo, The Synthesis of Yoga, Part 2, The Yoga of Integral Knowledge, Chapter 3, The Purified Understanding, page 308. The description of the status of knowledge to which we aspire determines the means of knowledge which we shall use. That status of knowledge may be summed up as a supramental realization, which is prepared by mental representations through various mental principles in us, and, once attained, again reflects itself more perfectly in all the members of the being. It is a re-seeing, and therefore a remolding, of our whole existence in the light of the divine and one and eternal, free from subjection to the appearances of things and the externalities of our superficial being. Such a passage, from the human to the divine, from the divided and discordant to the one, from the phenomenon to the eternal truth, such an entire rebirth, or new birth of the soul, must necessarily involve two stages. One of preparation, in which the soul and its instruments must become fit, and another of actual illumination and realization in the prepared soul through its fit instruments. There is indeed no rigid line of demarcation in sequence of time between these two stages. Rather, they are necessary to each other and continue simultaneously. For in proportion as the soul becomes fit, it increases in illumination and rises to higher and higher, completer and completer realizations. And in proportion as these illuminations and these realizations increase, becomes fit, and its instruments more adequate to their task. There are soul seasons of unillumined preparation and soul seasons of illumined growth and culminating soul moments, more or less prolonged, of illumined possession, moments that are transient, like the flash of the lightning, yet change the whole spiritual future, moments also that extend over many human hours, days, weeks, in a constant light or blaze of the sun of truth. And through all these the soul, once turned Godwards, grows towards the permanence and perfection of its new birth and real existence. The first necessity of preparation is the purifying of all the members of our being, especially for the path of knowledge, the purification of the understanding, the key that shall open the door of truth. And a purified understanding is hardly possible without the purification of the other members. An unpurified heart, an unpurified sense, an unpurified life confuse the understanding, disturb its data, distort its conclusions, darken its seeing, misapply its knowledge. An unpurified physical system clogs or chokes up its action. There must be an integral purity. Here also there is an interdependence, for the purification of each member of our being profits by the clarifying of every other. The progressive tranquilization of the emotional heart, helping, for instance, the purification of the understanding, while equally a purified understanding imposes calm and light on the turbid and darkened workings of the yet impure emotions. It may even be said that while each member of our being has its own proper principles of purification, yet it is the purified understanding that in man is the most potent cleanser of his turbid and disordered being, and most sovereignly imposes their right working on his other members. Knowledge, says the Gita, is the sovereign purity. Light, is the source of all clearness and harmony, even as the darkness of ignorance is the cause of all our stumblings. Love, for example, is the purifier of the heart, and by reducing all our emotions into terms of divine love, the heart is perfected and fulfilled. Yet love itself needs to be clarified by divine knowledge. The heart's love of God may be blind, narrow, and ignorant, and lead to fanaticism and obscurantism. It may, even when otherwise pure, limit our perfection by refusing to see Him except in a limited personality and by recoiling from the true and infinite vision. The heart's love of man may equally lead to distortions and exaggerations in feeling, action, and knowledge, which have to be corrected and prevented by the purification of the understanding. We must, however, consider deeply and clearly what we mean by the understanding and by its purification. We use the word as the nearest equivalent we can get in the English tongue to the Sanskrit philosophical term buddhi. Therefore, we exclude from it the action of the sense mind, which merely consists of the recording of perceptions of all kinds, without distinction whether they be right or wrong, true, or mere illusory phenomena, penetrating or superficial. We exclude that mass of confused conception which is merely a rendering of these perceptions and is equally void of the higher principle of judgment and discrimination. Nor can we include that constant leaping current of habitual thought, which does duty for understanding in the mind of the average unthinking man, but is only a constant repetition of habitual associations, desires, prejudices, prejudgments, received or inherited preferences, even though it may constantly enrich itself by a fresh stock of concepts streaming in from the environment and admitted without the challenge of the sovereign discriminating reason. Undoubtedly, this is a sort of understanding which has been very useful in the development of man from the animal. But it is only one remove above the animal mind. It is a half-animal reason subservient to habit, to desire and the senses, and is of no avail in the search, whether for scientific or philosophical or spiritual knowledge. We have to go beyond it. Its purification can only be effected either by dismissing or silencing it altogether, or by transmuting it into the true understanding. By the understanding, we mean that which at once perceives, judges, and discriminates. The true reason of the human being, not subservient to the senses, to desire, or to the blind force of habit, but working in its own right for mastery, for knowledge. Certainly, the reason of man as he is at present does not even at its best act entirely in this free and sovereign fashion. But so far as it fails because it is still mixed with the lower half-animal action, because it is impure and constantly hampered and pulled down from its characteristic action. In its purity, it should not be involved in these lower movements, but stand back from the object and observe disinterestedly, put it in its right place in the whole by force of comparison, contrast, analogy, reason from its rightly observed data by deduction, induction, inference, and holding all its gains in memory and supplementing them by a chastened and rightly guided imagination. View all in the light of a trained and disciplined judgment. Such is the pure intellectual understanding of which disinterested observation, judgment, and reasoning are the law and characterizing action. But the term buddhi is also used in another and profounder sense. The intellectual understanding is only the lower buddhi. There is another and a higher buddhi, which is not intelligence, but vision, is not understanding, but rather an overstanding in knowledge, and does not seek knowledge and attain it in subjection to the data it observes, but possesses already the truth and brings it out in the terms of a revelatory and intuitional thought. The divine being is described as the Adyaksha, he who is seated over all in the supreme ether, oversees things, views and controls them from above. The nearest the human mind usually gets to this truth conscious knowledge is that imperfect action of illumined finding, which occurs when there is a great stress of thought and the intellect electrified by constant discharges from behind the veil and yielding to a higher enthusiasm, admits a considerable streaming from the intuitive and inspired faculty of knowledge. For there is an intuitive mind in man, which serves as a recipient and channel for these streamings from a supramental faculty. But the action of intuition and inspiration in us is imperfect and kind as well as intermittent in action. Ordinarily, it comes in response to a claim from the laboring and struggling heart or intellect, and even before its givings enter the conscious mind, they are already affected by the thought or aspiration which went up to meet them, are no longer pure, but altered to the needs of the heart or intellect. And after they enter the conscious mind, they are immediately seized upon by the intellectual understanding and dissipated or broken up so as to fit in with our imperfect intellectual knowledge, or by the heart, and remolded to suit our blind or half-blind emotional longings and preferences, or even by the lower cravings and distorted to the vehement uses of our hungers and passions. If this higher buddhi could act pure of the interference of these lower members, it would give pure forms of the truth. Observation would be dominated or replaced by a vision which could see without subservient dependence on the testimony of the sense mind and senses. Imagination would give place to the self-assured inspiration of the truth, reasoning to the spontaneous discernment of relations, and conclusion from reasoning to an intuition containing in itself those relations and not building laboriously upon them. Judgment to a thought vision in whose light the truth would stand revealed without the mask which it now wears, and which our intellectual judgment has to penetrate, while memory too would take upon itself that larger sense given to it in Greek thought, and be no longer a paltry selection from the store gained by the individual in his present life, but rather the all-recording knowledge which secretly holds and constantly gives from itself everything that we now seem painfully to acquire. But really, in this sense, remember, a knowledge which includes the future no less than the past. In this sense, the power of prophecy has been aptly called a memory of the future. Certainly, we are intended to grow in our receptivity to this higher faculty of truth-conscious knowledge, but its full and unveiled use is as yet the privilege of the gods and beyond our present human stature.